This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello there, and welcome to our weekly review of the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel here in the studio. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Good afternoon.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
And from our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
From our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Hello.
Well, there's basically one story in the news right now, as far as most media outlets are concerned, and we are going to get to some discussion of the coronavirus a little later in today's program, but I wanted to start by looking at a couple of stories that show that Bible prophecy continues to advance in other areas as well. We're going to start with a big story out of Russia, where Vladimir Putin has taken steps to cement his rule for a long time to come. And this points to a very specific prophecy our editor-in-chief has highlighted. For this, we'll go to Jeremiah.
Yes, before we get to that specific news, I wanted to review a little bit of the recent history of Vladimir Putin, who has actually been the leader of Russia for this entire millennium so far. So from the year 2000, when he first came into power, until 2008, he spent those 8 years just consolidating Russia economically, socially, politically, and militarily, and he had extraordinary success with that. His policies during those first 8 years lifted millions of Russians out of poverty and started to really restore Russia's international relevance. But then in 2008, even though Putin and most of his people felt that he was only just getting started, There was a problem that he faced, and that was that Russia's constitution says a person cannot be president for more than two consecutive terms. So he had reached the end of his second term, so he did let go of the presidency at that time, but he did not let go of political power. He ended up handing the office of president over to one of his proteges who was, you know, submissive to him. And that was a really important era for Putin. That's when he invaded the nation of Georgia and showed the world that even though the Soviet Union had collapsed, Russia was back, and it was a power to be feared and respected once again. So then in 2012, Vladimir Putin returned to the presidency. By this time, he had changed it so that each term lasts 6 years instead of four, and he kept on tightening his grip on power, and he, you know, kept on making Russia's foreign policy more and more aggressive. And then in 2018, he won another six-year term. But ever since then, ever since that presidential election victory in 2018, Putin has been acutely aware of the fact that he would soon come up against that constitutional limitation once again in 2024. That's when he will have completed two consecutive presidential terms once again, so he would be required to step down. So for the last few years, he's been weighing all kinds of different options for what to do at that time. There's evidence that he's considered orchestrating another iteration of that castling move that he did back in 2008. There's also evidence that he has considered trying to take over Belarus and becoming the head of a new Russia-Belarus combine. He's also considered ruling through parliament or from the post of Russia's state council. But on Tuesday, after all those various options had been weighed in the balance and found wanting, Putin told Russian lawmakers that the clock should be reset to zero for his presidential term limits so that he can remain in office after 2024. So it's not totally written in stone yet, but the path is basically being cleared for Putin to hold two more terms starting in 2024, which would potentially extend his reign to 2036 when he'll be 84 years old. So, you know, analysts have been speculating for years about how exactly he would retain power after 2024. And it looks like that was answered this week. He's taking a page out of the dictator's playbook and rewriting the Constitution for himself.
So he says, let's just set the clock back to zero as if he had had no prior presidential terms, which is quite an extraordinary move. But he said that that's not something that we would want to keep actually enshrined in the Constitution for just anyone to be able to use. This is a really unique situation that really only he should be able to take advantage of.
That's a really important aspect of this. He mentioned the Tsarist era of Russia and the Soviet era when no elections were held during either of those times. And he said, we don't need to go back to a time like that. Russia's had enough revolutions. And he made clear that for most people, for his successors, he wants to make sure that that term limit is enshrined in the Constitution. But for himself, conveniently, there should be this massive exception, which comes on top of so many exceptions that have already been made for him.
Yeah. So any idea of what's the justification for this? How can he speak with a straight face to his people and say, you know, we definitely want to maintain all of the norms of democracy, but we just have to make this one exception?
His favorite word this week has been stability. Once Russia is stabilized totally and stronger, then we can become more democratic and let parliament have more power. But until that time, we need me to continue to stabilize it and to basically build that stability.
So if we don't call him president, then what title should we give him?
Yeah, well, you know, now that his dictatorial colors are really on full display, it does seem, I think, silly to call him president, because that title has democratic connotations. I think it would be far more appropriate to call him something like supreme leader. That's what the North Korean leader is called, or paramount leader. That's what Putin's counterpart in China is called, or maybe something like the leader of the nation. That's the title used by Kazakhstan's longtime dictator. Any of those would be more fitting than president at this time. But there's another title that in Putin's case may be even more appropriate and even more fitting. Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury wrote a landmark article about Vladimir Putin back in 2014. And part of that article says, quote, "We need to watch Vladimir Putin closely because he is the prince of Rosh that God inspired Ezekiel to write about 2,500 years ago." In this article, Mr. Fleury takes a look at prophecies in the books of Daniel and Jeremiah, Joel, and Revelation. And when you put these all together, they paint a picture of this multinational Asian army that will come together in the end time. And it shows that it'll have an army of 200 million soldiers, so just a stunning size. And Mr. Fleury spends a lot of time in this article discussing what the book of Ezekiel says about it as well. He points to a passage in chapter 38 where Ezekiel talks about the man who will be the main ruler. And it calls him the Prince of Rosh, as the quote there said, the Prince of Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal. And Meshach and Tubal are ancient names designating modern regions of Russia, now modern cities. And then the word Rosh is a variation of an ancient name for Russia. So this is describing the Prince of Russia. And Mr. Fleury wrote that he believes Putin is that prince. So, you know, I think in light of these prophecies and in light of Putin's moves this week toward really kind of crowning himself more and more of an absolute monarch over Russia, I think it is time that we consider hanging up the president label for him and think more about this title from the Bible here, the Prince of Russia.
Well, Jeremiah has written an article about this subject that went up on the website this week. It's time to stop calling Vladimir Putin president. And we'll link to that in the show notes. You can check that out on the front page of The Trumpet. And also The Prophesied Prince of Russia, that booklet by Gerald Fleury, we'll make available to you there as well. Thanks for that, Jeremiah. America has taken military action against Iran, or Iranian proxies at least. Yesterday, the U.S. struck targets in Iraq and Syria. More direct confrontation with the Islamic Republic. To learn about this, we'll turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
We'll just take it back a day earlier to see what the U.S. was retaliating for. Wednesday would have been the 63rd birthday of Qasem Soleimani, the now deceased leader of the Quds Force for Iran. He, of course, was killed earlier this year by the United States. And the other leader that was killed alongside him was the head of Kataib Hezbollah, a Shiite group that answers to Iran with about 15,000 troops inside Iraq. And this group previously had targeted U.S. forces in Iraq and they had killed a U.S. serviceman. Well, on Wednesday, which was the anniversary again of when he would, well, his birthday, I suppose, is Soleimani's, this group, Kataib Hezbollah, fired again at the United States, this time at the Taji base, and this time did actually end up killing two U.S. servicemen, injured five more seriously, and killed a British serviceman as well. So three dead from this attack. It was 17 rockets out of 30 that were fired towards the base that actually hit. And so the United States decided that it was going to respond, and it fired at five different locations, hitting back against Kataib Hezbollah, who are, again, an Iranian proxy. And so this battle space of Iraq continues to exist between the United States and Iran. The United States announced today that it is sending Patriot missile batteries to Iraq to defend its bases there. And it's also interesting considering that this was the red line for President Trump, and he said in the retaliation strikes that Iran had against the U.S. forces in Iraq after the death of Soleimani, that if you kill an American serviceman, we're coming to get you and we're coming hard.
Right.
And yet some time has passed since then, and two servicemen have been killed. And the United States seems to have attacked five locations, which it looks like there might have been a dozen Kataib Hezbollah fighters killed. However, not really the overwhelming response we would have expected had this same thing happened 2 or 3 months ago.
Yeah, it's interesting. I guess with the coronavirus, we've been talking mostly about just how much Iran has been hit by this, and this is kind of coming on the heels of some other setbacks that Iran has had, but they don't seem to be interested in slowing down in terms of finding ways to strike out.
Right. They're still pushing very hard at trying to get American forces out of Iraq. That's a huge goal of theirs, a huge goal of their Shiite proxies there. And while we haven't had American servicemen killed, there have been about 30 of these rocket attacks in the past 6 months against U.S. forces in Iraq. They just haven't killed anyone yet.
Yeah.
And so the U.S. response has been quite minimal, but Iran has still been pushing to get rid of U.S. forces from there. And then this muted response from the United States seems to indicate that at least they don't want a war right now with Iran. They don't want to ratchet up tensions with Iran. The president's dealing with so many other things right now. But Iran, though it's on its knees, it looks like, because of Corona and other things, they are still able to fight against U.S. forces without huge retribution. And we wrote an article after the death of Qasem Soleimani. It was entitled After Soleimani. I think it was in the previous print edition. And we talked about some of the things that are going to continue for Iran. We did say that they might draw down forces in some areas. But in Iraq, we said they are going to maintain a strong presence there and not give up Iraq. And that's what we've seen take place. They're continuing to fight against American forces inside Iraq.
Yeah, the fundamentals are really unchanged. And this is at the same time that the United States is making a deal with the Taliban to try to withdraw from Afghanistan. President Trump's desire to pull America out, draw down from the Middle East, has been clear, and he's taking steps to do that. And so as hard as he has shown himself willing to strike against Iran, and he's reimposed sanctions, pulled out of the nuclear deal, killed Soleimani, still it doesn't change his fundamental desire to get out of there. And Iran remains as radical as it ever was, which is exactly what Bible prophecy says.
Yeah, we've spoken about how Bible prophecy indicates strongly that Iran is going to maintain its desire for regional hegemony, which will then extend outwards to, and even push it Europe. And so that's what we see taking place here. Yes, limited resources, but when their backs against the wall and they have limited resources, they still find enough to be firing rockets every single week, it seems, at U.S. forces and others in the region. So really do expect Iran, even though it's struggling right now, to continue to push at the United States, especially to get them out of Iraq. And it's only a matter of time before that takes place, as is the desire by President Trump as well.
Well, we'll link to that article after Soleimani in the show notes, and also our booklet by our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, the King of the South, that explains Iran's role in prophecy. Thank you for that, Brent. Okay, now to some coronavirus news. We'll start in Italy, which is suffering massive economic destruction that could really threaten the whole of Europe. For this story, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, Italy now outside of China is probably the biggest, most affected place by the coronavirus. The latest stats that I have here have 15,000 cases there, with over 1,000 people having died. And the way the government's dealing with this is they've just about shut down the entire country. Over the course of the week, the shutdown got harsher and harsher. Now the whole country has been declared a red zone. It's been declared quarantined. Only pharmacies and supermarkets and, you know, kind of just the really essentials are left open. Cafes, restaurants, sporting events, everything like that is closed. There were some fairly harrowing reports from Lombardy and some of those northern Italian towns. It does show how fragile modern society is. It's killed 1,000 people, so it's not necessarily, I mean, that's definitely tragic, but it's not gigantic either. But still, the hospitals are running out of hospital beds. Now they're running out of doctors. They're running out of medical staff. The worry is that now you're going to get more and more people dying who might have otherwise have been able to survive this disease had it come through that region more slowly. But that particular region is suffering from all of these shortages, and there's a real fear that things can get worse. And then when you look at the economic hit that Italy has gone through, it's just vast. The former head or deputy director in Europe of the International Monetary Fund, he said that Italy would require somewhere around $500 billion US dollars, a bailout to kind of recover from this. You've had a massive fall in bank stocks over in Italy and all of Europe. But this figure, that completely dwarfs anything that Europe has ever bailed out any of their other countries before in times of financial crises and that kind of thing. It's a huge amount of money. So I think what you see is already, even if coronavirus were to kind of magically disappear tomorrow, there are going to be some huge, long-lasting economic and political effects from this disease, even, you know, let alone the kind of the human tragedy here.
So we've been tracking economic problems in Europe for quite some time, and Italy has really been in the vanguard of a lot of those problems. How does this affect, how might this actually reshape the landscape in Europe over the time to come in light of what's been happening there in recent years?
Yeah, I think you've got a couple of big ways that this could tie through and hit them. So you've got the political effects, where the far right in Italy, Matteo Salvini, that has already been hugely popular and were out of government, pushed out of government just a few months before the coronavirus came through. They're looking now to make real political capital from what's been happening. They've been blaming the government. They've been trying to link the coronavirus outbreak with Italy's migrants and saying, well, the government was letting too many migrants in, and that's why we had the situation. I think nobody is too keen to go door to door in Italy taking poll numbers right now, so nobody can be sure of exactly what the polling figures are like. But you've got this is definitely going to have a political impact on Italy. I think it's just a question of what that impact will be and how big it will be. But you could certainly see it pushing Italy towards the far right and all of Europe potentially, as you have those powers blaming the government, just like they're doing in the United States. If anything happens, it's always the government's fault. The extremist parties tend to be out of government, and they can point to the government and say, well, you've not done enough. If we were in power, we would have done it so much better. Mm-hmm. And then you've got the economic aspect, where Europe is stuck in this kind of awkward halfway state towards being a super state. In the United States, you have a bunch of states that share a currency, but they also have all kinds of different ways for money to flow between the different states to where it's needed most. You know, for example, all the states pay money into one federal pot in the form of federal taxation. And so then if one state suffers, well, that money helps that one state out. you've also got the federal government overseeing banks in all the states, promising to guarantee a certain amount of the deposits in all of those banks throughout the state. And if California's banks get into trouble, the entire credit of the United States stands behind that. And so all of that stops a whole load of crises. And you don't have that in Europe at the moment. You have the common currency, the euro, but you don't have all of those practical institutions that help keep a common currency together and help solve those problems. Hmm. That common currency means that a problem in Italy very quickly affects Germany, that if Italy's banks do go under as a result of this and they're having to deal with things like a three-month mortgage holiday and lots of tough, you know, they're struggling, they're losing money. Italy is the world's fourth most indebted economy by some measures. So Italy's already got these real problems. That could spread easily throughout Europe, but then they don't have the shared mechanisms to fix it. So you could also see the aftermath of coronavirus forcing Europe to finally put in place, you know, those nuts and bolts of just the very practical components of a super state. Perhaps the boring components, but the ones mm-hmm. that you need to have a super state. And you could see this really pushing European integration. And we've not forecast the
euro. Yeah, that's something that we've been talking about for years, the fact that even when the euro was initially established, the fact that it lacked those superstructures that you're talking about, those continent-wide or euro-wide institutions, that was one of the problems with that those who established the currency to begin with were looking to create some kind of a crisis that would necessitate the implementation of that kind of superstructure.
Right. They kind of knew that if they didn't move the rest of the way, it would cause a crisis. But then that crisis would cause them to go the rest of the way. It's often the way Europe works.
Yeah.
Jean Monnet, one of Europe's founding fathers, he said that Europe will be forged in crisis and will be the sum of the solutions adopted to those crises. So you can really see that this could help push Europe together. But we have a trends article, Why the Trumpet Watches Europe's Ongoing Unification Project. And that will take you through what the Bible says about what's coming in Europe, this 10-nation superstate that the Bible talks about in Revelation chapter 17. And with its common currency and things like that, the Eurozone is already a long way towards being that superstate. And you know, the Bible, Mr. Armstrong was talking about it, Herbert W. Armstrong was talking about a European Union all the way back in 1945. He forecasted so much of what we see already. And you could see this taking us the rest of the way towards that super state that shares a lot of resources that he talked about. And then also just on the coronavirus, we've got that cover article from Trumpet editor Gerald Flurry in the latest Trumpet print magazine, Coronavirus and Other Modern Plagues in Prophecy, that is just a key place to go to see some of those scriptures that talk about these sicknesses that the Bible, I think everybody understands that, even if you don't know much about the Bible, that the Bible talks about plagues and sicknesses in these end times. But that article also talks about some of the reasons for that, why God has some of these diseases come through. And that Trumpet print talks about other ways that these are changing world events. There was this quote I like from the Telegraph where it says, as if deliberately this coronavirus has hit the Eurozone just where it hurts most, Italy. And you can see this disease now shaping world events from China and Russia mm-hmm. All the way to Europe and elsewhere in a way that really does align with Bible prophecy. So that article, Coronavirus and Other Modern Plagues in Prophecy, is a great place to go to understand more about that as well.
Well, thank you very much for that, Richard. With all of this going on in Europe, U.S. President Donald Trump decided to suspend all travel into the United States from Europe, one of many measures that could have significant economic, even geopolitical implications for America. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, the coronavirus, it definitely hasn't hit America as bad as it's hit Europe. There's only about 1,135 cases here and 38 deaths. But it is increasing fast enough that President Trump on Wednesday addressed the nation and took the step you just mentioned, starting today for a few weeks, banning all travel from the Schengen zone of the European Union that exempts Britain and any American citizens who may be traveling in Europe. But other for like Europeans coming here, that is shut down, which is going to have definitely some economic implications, and then even reveals some geopolitical implications that European Union leaders weren't thrilled with the announcement. Both the European Council President Charles Michel and the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen have expressed their displeasure with the move, saying that Trump took these steps unilaterally, and we need to be looking at global solutions to this crisis. And so you can definitely see the tension there between the European Union and the United States. I wouldn't go so far as to say that the coronavirus has caused the tension, that it's just kind of revealed the underlying tensions between the Trump administration and Europe that exist. But on the economic side, economists are estimating that by the end of this year, global exports are going to be reduced by about $50 billion. That's about $5 billion in U.S. exports that aren't going to get shipped around the world because of the ramifications of coronavirus. And then even worse for Europe, probably about $15 billion in European Union exports that aren't going to make it to their final destinations. So just that hit in the hardcore goods you're trading around the world, in addition to like all the services, things like the Richard mentioned in the beginning half of in Italy about how many businesses are closed down. Here, like I said, the National Basketball Association has been closed down for a few weeks, and so that's a lot of ticket sales there.
Mm-hmm.
That are causing economists to think that they're given the chances of a recession hitting this year at about a 50-50 chance. But at the very least, they're saying the economy is going to be growing a lot slower than it would have been if the world and the United States hadn't been hit by a pandemic.
Stephen Fleury, I think, has just done an excellent job on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show the last two mornings and just bringing some perspective to this. It's remarkable just how severe the reaction within the United States has been to something that has really affected very few people, but comparing it to the way that we've handled influenzas, the swine flu, N1H1 in the past, where we just took a much more measured approach. Now it's this kind of, we're destroying our own economy to try to prevent this from spreading any further. I think the swine flu, it killed something like 1,000 people in the United States, or maybe it was a couple of thousand. But it was very similar kind of circumstances, and the way that people responded, we didn't gut our economy for the sake of dealing with this. We just took kind of a measured response to it, and we weathered it to the point that, you know, looking back, you hardly even remember that happened. But here you're talking about, we've wiped out all of the stock market gains that have built up since President Trump took office, and who knows how much worse the economic impact could be.
Yeah, because they said there have been about $11.5 trillion in stock market value that had been accrued since President Trump was elected, and all of that's been wiped out. I mean, the stock market's been pretty volatile. Maybe some of it will come back. It's been bouncing up and down for the past several weeks, but it does just show, economies are based on confidence, and apparently, like I said, with the swine flu, even though it had killed more people than coronavirus has killed so far, you definitely didn't see the same level of fear of a global pandemic that you've seen with this one, and that loss of confidence can just really reshape economies, reshape trade routes. I mean, like I said, stock market might come back, but some of these, when you start trading less with this nation because of a quarantine and trading more with this other nation, some of those legacies can remain. And like Richard mentioned earlier, it's like you don't have to know very much about the Bible to know that these plagues are very significant. There's all sorts of prophecies about plagues, including actually probably the most important prophecy about Christ's return in Matthew 24. Our editor-in-chief has a book, pretty recent, well, it's a couple years old, entitled Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door. And he has a statement in there, Mr. Gerald Flory. They said, Matthew 24 is the most important prophecy that Jesus Christ proclaimed at his first coming. In Matthew 24, Christ interprets the seven seals of Revelation 6 and 8. The first four of these are referred to as the four horsemen of the apocalypse. The seven seals that form the story flow of Revelation, here's an overview. The first seal reveals false religion, the second war, the third famine, the fourth pestilence, the fifth tribulation, the sixth heavenly signs, and the seventh trumpets. If you understand these seals, they lead you step by step to the return of Jesus Christ. And there is some overlap with those four horsemen. There's been wars and religious deception and famine and plagues for some time now. But looking at this step by step process, it is just interesting to note that like pestilence is the horseman that comes right before Great Tribulation.
Yeah.
So when you see things like this happen more and more often, like I said, that maybe coronavirus will go the way of the swine flu and there'll be another plague after that. But it's like the fact that these big plagues are starting to stack up is that step before Great Tribulation and these seven seals.
Yeah, it seems to me there's little doubt that this will fizzle out and probably within a few months. But what I find amazing is the fact that it has created such widespread disruption, being as minor as it is, that it has just done incredible economic devastation, and there's so many of these geopolitical ramifications that we've been talking about for something that's relatively minor. And what happens when a real pandemic, like something that is really deadly, comes along and begins to wreak havoc among nations? It just seems like this has given a very strong picture of just how easily something like that could flip the world on its head, even far more than this has. Well, we will put a link to that booklet, Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door, in the show notes, and also the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, a booklet that is really worth going back through and reading again. That is available on the literature tab in our literature library at thetrumpet.com. So go check that out. Thank you very much for that. Andrew, you're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, a look at how Israel is faring with trying to form a government and a massive plague of locusts that is causing alarming food shortages in several regions. These stories and more right after a short break.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Benjamin Netanyahu's election victory increased his party's seats in the Knesset, but he's still short of the seats he needs for a majority in order to govern, and there is an ugly reason for this. For this, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, it seems like there could be nothing decisive in Israeli elections, and this epic saga continues. But this week, it did really turn for the worse in exposing how far the opposite side is willing to go to get rid of Netanyahu as prime minister. As you mentioned, Likud, Netanyahu's party, won the most seats it's ever won, actually, in an election. And it overwhelmed Blue and White, who had received more votes than Likud in the previous two elections. Both of those were they went forward without a Knesset majority, however. And so we have this situation where Netanyahu, only with his support of his right wing coalition, can only get 58 seats. And then the other side, the other coalition, Blue and White, with Benny Gantz's coalition, they could only get 40 some seats. However, Blue and White has decided that it is willing to accept as part of its coalition, at least to oust Netanyahu, the Arab List, or the Joint List, which is a couple of Arab parties. The Arab parties did extremely well in this election, getting the most seats they've ever got. They got 15 seats. And so this was a campaign promise that was repeated often, time and time again, by Blue and White, that they would not ever make a coalition with these Arab parties, because these Arab parties are against the law of return for Jews, which basically means if you're a Jew anywhere in the world, you can come back to Israel if you can prove that you're a Jew, because this nation is meant to be a safe haven for the Jews. This Arab, or the Joint List, are against that policy. They are for the right of return of the Palestinian refugees, of which there's millions in Syria, Jordan, elsewhere. And so they have said that they were not going to ally with that party, Blue and White did. However, since they couldn't receive or didn't receive a majority after the election, they seem to have no choice but to side with Blue and White, but to side with the Arabs to get rid of Netanyahu.
They're more willing to align themselves with these Arabs who essentially have a destruction of the Jewish state kind of a policy than they are to ally with Netanyahu.
Yeah, it's completely surprising that they would go this far, and it seems to be just an absolutely horrendous policy for the Blue and White Party, because the majority of Israeli public are against this. There was a poll taken that showed that half of those people that voted for Blue and White do not want this to happen. They don't want to side with an anti-Zionist, meaning we hear the term Zionist and we think like somebody that's, you know, on the front lines killing every Arab he sees. That's not Zionist. Zionist just believes that the state of Israel has a right to exist. Yeah. You've got these anti-Zionists, which belong to these Arab parties, that plenty of thinking people that were basically fed up with Netanyahu voted for Blue and White, but they would not go so far as to ally with the Arab parties. And yet that's what Blue and White has decided to do. Now, I don't know how this is going to go forward, because Blue and White is already suffering from a couple of people inside their party saying, hey, we're not, this is political suicide for my future.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be a part of this. And you even had somebody from one of the left-leaning parties, one of Gesher, another party that was allied with Blue and White. They said, this is even too crazy for us. We're not going down that road. And so what this is really exposing, and what a number of people are writing about, is it is exposing just how strong the hatred is amongst the radical left leadership of Benjamin Netanyahu. And again, Netanyahu received, or 48% of the nation believes that Netanyahu deserves to be prime minister.
Yeah.
And yet you're going to have the second leading vote getter party that's willing to ally with an anti-Zionist party to get rid of him, which is really scary for democratic norms inside Israel. You also have the coronavirus, which is really like upsetting a lot of people here, and they're worried about it. And so at this precise time, most Israelis are not for, they actually support Netanyahu to get them through this. And for Blue and White to come forward in this way shows where their heart is. And it looks like they might not even be able to have enough of a majority to even bring this together, because of the deserters. And so it looks like we might be heading to another election. We'll see if
that
actually happens.
Unbelievable. So Netanyahu has 58 seats. You need 61 seats to govern. And Blue and White is essentially putting the nation back into this position where they cannot have a governing coalition, essentially out of spite for the man that the people of Israel voted for. Amazing.
I think what this really does expose is that you have this spirit inside the radical left over here that is going mainstream, that is really strongly against the state of Israel. It's a similar spirit to what we see in the United States and what we saw under President Obama, and that the deep state that continues over there in the United States that President Trump is trying to get rid of. I mean, you've had some of these same advisors to President Obama that are advising the Blue and White Party, and you can't help but see a hatred for the Jewish state that is embodied in their hatred for Prime Minister Netanyahu, who has done so much for Israel and who so many of the Israelis actually support. And so I'll be writing this up next week in an article with more explanation of this if people care to read it.
Thank you for that, Brent. We'll look forward to reading that. Well, everyone is focused on the coronavirus, but there's another plague, far less reported, that is threatening food, health, and jobs on three continents. For this story, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, this is an emergency that's afflicting three major regions. And as you said, it's really going woefully underreported right now. And that is the locust swarms that are threatening food and health and jobs in Asia, the Middle East, and Africa. So the insect that's doing all the damage here is called the desert locust, or the Schistocerca gregaria. It is considered the most dangerous migratory pest on Earth. And they're really an annual fixture of the rainy season. So they breed and they swarm every year. But what's abnormal about this year is that there have been unusually heavy rains in the parts of East Africa where they breed. And so these rains have softened the ground there, and it's created circumstances that have made their swarm sizes way off the charts. So some of these swarms are the size of cities right now, dozens of miles across in diameter. So that's the biggest by a considerable margin that we've seen in at least 25 years in many places. And they've been just devouring acres and acres of farmland and crops, not just in East Africa where they originated, but now also across the Middle East and well into South Asia. And the devastation right now has actually kind of died down, but that's only because we're right in between two different hatchings. So there's a second hatching is imminent. It'll be in the next few weeks, and that one could be just devastating beyond words because the first one was already so much larger than is typical.
So what is this doing? How is this affecting people, and how many people?
Well, there was an article about this week that appeared in the journal Nature, and it talks about an urgent appeal that was filed by the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization. They're asking for $138 million worth of funding to assist with it. And Nature calculates now that since this is beginning to threaten some of those very populous places in Pakistan and moving into India as well, it means that around 20 million people are now facing a food crisis or will be very soon. So it's some very significant numbers there if it ends up being as significant as those estimates show.
So we were talking about the plague of coronavirus being a fulfillment of prophecy regarding pestilence. How does this factor into Bible prophecies? This definitely is one that even a lot of secular sources label as like a biblical curse.
Yes, that's exactly right. I think it's fascinating right now that we're, you know, most of the headlines are dominated by pestilence. One of the horsemen that represents disease, you could say, mentioned there in Revelation 6 and also in Matthew 24. But then we've got the other horse here as well. Famine is really demonstrated by this devastation that we see being wreaked across three different very populous regions of the world. And Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury, as mentioned earlier, has written a booklet called The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse with co-writer Mr. Wayne Turgeon. And one part of their booklet stresses that most of these prophecies are for the present age. One quote of it says, "We are not discussing some dusty old prophecies. These are dramatic, dire prophecies that lie directly in front of us." And then a little further down, they speak specifically about famine. It says, "Great famine will eventually spread to every corner of the earth before mankind repents in unconditional surrender to God." So I think this booklet is just very timely. I think it's becoming more relevant all the time as we see some signs of these horsemen galloping across different regions of the earth. So I would just encourage any listener who doesn't have a copy of it to order one now.
We also have an article that Jeremiah wrote in our November-December 2018 Trumpet print edition, Famine, the Black Horseman is Not Finished Writing. A really interesting article that shows different ways that famine can show itself and become a major problem for vast populations. Read that article as well. We'll link to that in our show notes along with that Four Horsemen booklet. And thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. Immigration to the United States continues to be a major problem that is overwhelming the government's ability to contain it. To learn about this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, the migrant crisis, I mean, it's been going on for for decades, but especially in the past 2 years, there have been immigrants just flooding into the country to the point where the head of Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency made some comments on Wednesday that kind of got overshadowed, understandably, by the president's comments on coronavirus. But he's talking that at the current rate of deportation, it would take 140 years to remove all the illegal immigrants who've come to our border in the past two. It's just really a shocking way to put the statistics. I mean, I've heard these statistics before where they say that in the past 2 years there have been 900,000 immigrants apprehended at the border. The government only has about 60,000 beds to hold these immigrants as they wait for their trial to see if they're getting asylum or not, which means that the vast majority of those 900,000, I guess that's going to be 800,040, are done what they call catch and release. And then those ones have joined more that have been caught and then put on the waiting list before that two-year period, bringing the total number of immigrants in America awaiting for a hearing up to 3.3 million.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so all those statistics I've heard before, but it's a really shocking way to put that. It's basically saying that he's like, of that 3.3 million, if you divide that by how many we're
actually processing.
Processing each year, it's going to take us 140 years to process all of them. And assuming that 900,000 immigrants keep coming every two-year period for the next 140,000 or next 140 years.
we're not going to catch up.
Yeah, we're not going to catch up anytime soon, which is one of the reasons the more illegals come here, and just due to the fact that they know that, even if you don't get asylum, the waiting list is so long that it's like, well, I can stay till I'm 140 years old, and then I guess I have to go back home.
So how do you view this problem prophetically?
You know, this is something, I mean, it seems like it's gotten quite a bit of attention on this program over the past several weeks. But one of the articles we'll put in the show notes is Where America's Race Riots Are Leading by Mr. Fleury. And in that article, he really goes through a prophecy in Deuteronomy 28 and verse 52. I can just read an excerpt from it real quick, where he says that illegal aliens are pouring over the nation's southern border by the tens of thousands, but our leaders refuse to stop the flow. For many years, Herbert W. Armstrong said the siege God prophesied in Deuteronomy 28 verse 52 symbolized America's economy being battered by foreign powers. It says that then he shall besiege you in all these gates, and who has control of these strategic gates of international trade. But a little later in the article, he said, but notice the first part of 52. The second part of verse 52 is talking about these sea gates and this foreign trade competition. But the first part says America's high and fenced walls are coming down. And then he links that specifically with this verse that's like, okay, your high and fenced walls come down, and then illegal immigrants flow into the country, and that illegal immigration, it worsens the economic effect of this trade siege. So this verse 52 is kind of a 1-2 punch, with the walls coming down and the immigrants coming in, and then foreign governments besieging the country economically. But he wrote that article a couple years ago, right at the very beginning of the surge in migrants. And now looking at the statistics a couple years later, you just see how serious it's even come in that short period of time.
Well, we will link to that article, Where America's Race Riots Are Leading, in the show notes, and thank you for that. Andrew, one final story. The British government under Boris Johnson just released its new budget, and it isn't exactly a picture of economic self-discipline. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, just to cut out all of the details, it is massive spending, massive borrowing, massive infrastructure spending, hospital spending, tax increases, not the tax cuts that Boris Johnson promised when he was running for Conservative leadership. The Telegraph wrote that the Tory party switcheroo from the fiscal conservatism of the last 10 years to borrow to spend profligacy is one of the most damasking political conversions we've seen in a very long while. The last 10 years, Britain's conservative government has at least kind of had this pretense of austerity. The debt has still been going up, but the amount by which it has been going up each year has been reduced, and they focused on that, claiming to be getting spending under control. Now they've just completely abandoned all of that, and we're just skyrocketing up in debt.
This is exactly what is happening in the United States under a Republican administration. What is the response among conservatives?
Disappointment, but at the same time, kind of hopelessness. I mean, I don't think that there's nothing they can really do to change it at this point. Boris Johnson is pretty much the only game in town when it comes to the Conservative Party. He won a massive majority. And so, you know, it's there. And
this is kind of, it's the cost of Brexit, isn't it?
Yeah. And so, well,
I mean, in the sense that the people voted for Boris Johnson because he was the only way that they could get Brexit done. And now he's going down this road when it comes to the nation's finances.
Right. I mean, I guess you could have had potentially a different leader take a very different view. Most pro-Brexit people, I think, are not the massive spending type.
Right.
But yeah, I think the similarities with Mr. Trump are pretty interesting, where they can be, you can be quite sound, both Boris Johnson and Mr. Trump in some ways. But then you've got this, which, I mean, that's why the article I point to, if you want to learn more, is called The King of Debt by Trumpet executive editor Stephen Flurry. And he wrote that back in April 2018. And that's about President Trump, but it's exactly the same trend. You know, it's both Britain and America, we've got a temporary resurgence that the Bible talks about. And I think the debt exposes that more than ever. You spend that money, you borrow that money, and it makes things better temporarily. It boosts the economy temporarily. But that kick is got to come there. That penalty has to be paid. And it's not a recipe for long-term solving of our national problems. It's just a temporary boost. So that article explains that and just really emphasizes all the more why we need to take advantage of that temporary time that we're in.
Hmm. Well, thank you very much for that, Richard. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Nachtigall. Thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Winston Churchill. Knowledge of the past is the only foundation we have from which to peer into and try to measure the future. Expert knowledge, however indispensable, is no substitute for a generous and comprehending outlook upon the human story with all its sadness and with all its unquenchable hope. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.